speaking to the mic.
It's nice if I could be here and visit with you all today. I want to thank the C9 organizing group. And I want to talk about a number of things in the short time frame. I use generic terms based on some of the talks related to the bigger picture of what's going on at this meeting. And in order to get down to some more real critical issues that we deal on day-to-day basis, I just came over from an introductory presentation, and a graduate student of mine, Seth Murray, is at Texas A&M. He's throwing bombs at about everything related to molecular genetics, and I've been working on that for a while. I moved to the repository, the National Plant Germplasm System, in 1987. First at Geneva and subsequently at Griffin, Georgia. That was also sort of the dawning of molecular tools, whether it was Steve Tanks, Leon Eric Lander, and Andy Patterson doing mapping in tomatoes, or Charlie Stuber doing his work in maize. But it was really a dawn of a period. And the fundamental question that's been driving me since that time that I moved into a repository is, what is crop diversity? How do you characterize crop diversity? How do you conserve it effectively? And how do you make it more accessible for use in the future? So hopefully I'll cover some of those points in this presentation. So as background, I'll use sorghum. Sorghum is native to the Horn of Africa, and it's very diverse. There are five distinct races. Two are predominantly used for grain sorghum types. The other three are greatly underexploited. But beyond racial characterization, there are also types of sorghum highlighted in this slide. There's grain sorghum types predominant in the southern plains, sweet sorghum types for syrup in Appalachia, biomass sorghum types that are now being considered for energy-type cropping, and I also left out forage-type sorghums as well. So we have this multiplier of complexity. It's race times type, and also how and where those materials are utilized. And again, how to characterize material and how to make it more effectively useful for crop improvement programs. So with that as a background, I'm going to present two case studies that we're doing. First of all, focus on food quality sorghum. And there's an increased interest in this in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in the southern United States. Beyond food quality, we're also interested in quality for feed as well, and whether that's higher nutrition or improved energy per unit time. There's been an increased interest in sorghum in the southeastern United States, in particular for feed grains where maize is not, has problems with either weather or diseases. So we focus on that, and I'll talk a little bit about some of the background there. Okay. Again, starting with goals of C9, what we're trying to do is enhance nutrition while maintaining productivity. And again, I'll talk to you not as a breeder, but as somebody who's a plant genetic resources person, upstream providing help, insights, and information to people that are really doing that. Historically, a trade-off exists between grain yield components and ultimately yield. And there are examples here highlighting protein content by grain number, crude fat by 1,000 grain weight, or iron concentration by grain number. And what our objectives in the repository are, one, to identify useful genetic variation, and I'll highlight some of our GWAS studies, but we'll also look at other studies. As highlighted in the previous symposium, as genetic resources scientists, we look to corroborate evidence. I would feel really guilty if material went out of the repository that didn't have some stamp of approval by people looking at answering or understanding the question using multiple methods to do that. So frequently, if we're targeting particular traits, we go after multiple methods to sort of corroborate those activities, okay, or outcomes. Routinely now, we use near-infrared spectroscopy for grain quality components. And these are just the listing of the grain quality components that we routinely do in the material in repositories that we work with. One thing I want to highlight here, and I think it will come out in subsequent presentations, is In the old days, people would talk about germplasm evaluation. This is germplasm evaluation. But now it's built on a genetic foundation, so evaluation studies are also useful to help you think about the genetic basis of the phenotype that you're interested in. And most importantly on this slide, the lower level, is in a range of materials. This is approximately 4,000 different accessions from the repository. The repository at Griffin maintains about 40,000 accessions of sorghum. We could routinely work through 4,000 a year with the kind of work that we're trying to do. And from there, we develop useful subsets that go into subsequent testing for evaluation. So the materials that were highlighted here on this basis are a year's worth of work. So you can see the concentrations of particular traits in the grain. So amylose for 0 to 22%, starch 45 to 75%, crude protein, crude fat, energy. So there's extensive natural variation present. That was highlighted in the previous presentations in the previous symposium. There's tremendous variation. Classically, in the sorghum community, people work with converted lines because they're phenotypically associated with grain types, short stature, photoperiod, insensitive. So there's probably three-quarters of the collection that are photoperiod sensitive, that for reasons of ability to manage them and work with them, haven't been utilized. So there's a great wealth of information and genetic resources still to be exploited there. So we use near-infrared spectroscopy. Just want to highlight some of the variation based on a sorghum association panel of about 1,200 entries over a couple of years. And all I like to do is focus on these top three traits. And these are yield component traits. Grain number per panicle, 1,000 grain weight in grams, and yield per panicle in grain weight. So you can see the incredible range of grain number per panicle, 63 to 4,000 in a panicle. 1,000 grain weight, from as little as 5 grams to as many as 40 grams. And yield per panicle in grams, from 3.2 to 125. And also, you'll look at the right column there, and you'll notice there's high heritability with these things. So again, what we're trying to do is simultaneously look at yield components and nutritional quality, or quality characteristics that are desired by the stakeholder. We see more and more work that we do of stakeholders knowing exactly what they want in their product. Okay? And from the outcome of this work, we're able to generate information that looks at QTLs or SNPs that are associated with particular traits. So on this left side, you'll see grain number, 1,000 grain weight, panicle yield. And then you'll see us overlaying starch, amylose, protein, crude fat, gross energy. In some instances, you'll see regions of the genome that are useful in detecting probably pleiotropic things that go across many traits. However, like on chromosome 10 for crude fat and gross energy, you'll see examples of markers or regions that are associated with particular traits that are very, very specific to trait or to network. So with this as background, we subsequently move further. And again, highlighting previous work and discussions in the previous session that was on crop improvement, we want to corroborate data. And we want to find data that ultimately will be useful in a lot of different ways. So this focuses on a particular gene called TGAT1. This locus has been characterized in maize. And in maize, it's the last step and the rate-limiting step for lipid biosynthesis in maize seeds. So for a comparative context, plus the data that we generate ourselves, we have a good feeling that we're hitting on something that's going to be useful for those feed producers in the southeastern United States that are interested in increasing the energy content of the grain that they might use for feed. Okay? And the interesting thing, we found much higher resolution with the GWAS approach. And we talked a little bit earlier about the complexity. Patterson talked about cotton, Steve Benzinger talked about wheat, and Seth talked about maize. those genomes are gigantic. And the work that we do in sorghum is a lot easier. Our size of our genome is about 760 megabases, so a third of the size of some of those, third to a fourth of the size of some of those other, well, to maize in particular. So on this, using GBS markers that were developed through a BRED NSF project, we generate somewhere in the order between 250 to 400,000 markers per individual. So at that rate, and we know they're not equally distributed, but we have gene-level resolution because we have a marker that's located about every 2 to 3 kilobases. Really high-level resolution with the marker system that we're working with. We're interested in outliers, whether they're genes or genotypes. And this figure highlights an example of that. So mean panicle yield was lower in accessions containing higher fat levels. However, there's always exceptions to the rule. We found when we sequenced the DGET1 gene, we found a transcript that had a change for a particular amino acid associated with a SNP that characterizes this gene. You'll see on both of these figures to the right, in the upper right-hand corner, we found things that were actually higher in crude fat and concurrently panicle yield. General rules are general rules. Thoughtful people look for exceptions to the rules. So here's an example of an exception to a rule and things that we're pursuing in more detail now. So the take-home message for the grain quality improvement, or the first case study, is nutritional quality has been and is secondary to crop yield when grown for feed and fuel, but takes the precedence when produced for human consumption. And moreover, I think that's going to change for food and fuel production as well. All allele effects are not made equal. Some quality alleles affect yield while others do not. That's what you ultimately are looking for. And identifying genes for each grain quality trait enables idiotype breeding. And we work with people that are using these materials now. So I'll switch gears and I'll go into a bioenergy application. This is bioenergy sorghum in South Carolina. This crop probably grew in about 4 to 4.5 months on a coastal sandy soil with virtually no nutritional quality and no water holding capacity. This is work of Zach Breton highlighted here. So the interest that we have in the bioenergy story is, could we increase compositional quality positively affecting yield? And what I'd like to highlight is down below. In fuel bioenergy, yield is not simply total dry weight, but rather total extractable energy per unit area, per unit time, per unit input, whatever you want to put in the denominator. So the type of things that we try to focus on are major compositional quality constituents: C6 carbon, C5 carbons, lignin, non-structural carbohydrates, and minerals. Minerals could be a negative influence if you're a burning biomass. And again, what we try to do is link plant genetic resources, genomics, and biochemistry to target end products for the user community. We've developed and worked on to develop a bioenergy association panel associated with sorghum. Again, with as little as 400 entries, I want to highlight some of the changes that you see here. Dry matter yield from 3 to 20 dry tons per acre. Non-structural sugars, 3 to 20%. Cellulose, the C6 carbons, 15 to 40%. Hemicellulose, 14 to 38%. And lignin, 14 to 18% of the dry weight. And basically, for each one of those accessions, we have probably about 300,000 markers. So in addition to the evaluation, we're trying to do the preliminary genetic analyses to use these materials subsequently. This is an example, and it's from chromosome, well, I'll highlight chromosome 4. There's actually three haplotypes that are highlighted here. And you can see the associated percentage of non-structural carbohydrates associated with this gene. Again, it was a change in the transcript. We lucked out. It looks very interesting. you see almost double the amount of percent of non-structural carbohydrates, and maybe that's a function of materials stay in the form of simple sugars in the stem as opposed to materials that go into cellulose. But again, we're exploring this option with these contrasting haplotypes here. Could you increase compositional quality while simultaneously positively affecting yield? When you do the comparisons and look at interactions between phenotypes, cellulose, hemicellulose, lignin, non-structural, and ultimately dry weight, it doesn't look good. Generally speaking, it doesn't look good, unless if you're trying to increase lignin content or non-structural carbohydrates. There may be correlations with yield. Again, generalities are not what we're looking for. We're looking for particular specifics in those materials that we work with. So, can we increase composition quality and positively still affect yield? It depends on what the yield potential or what the yield of the particular entries are. What the metabolic cost of increased compositional quality is. Plants are factories. They make sugars more effectively than they make proteins, more effectively than they produce lipids. Yields are affected by composition because you're burning energy to reduce that carbon for the particular product. How much variation exists for the phenotypes in question? That's something that we do. With that, these are the things that we're focusing on to increase C6 carbon. We increase C4 photosynthesis through expanding sink strength. In sorghums, frequently you find carbon accumulation to grow greatly at the time of switching from vegetative to reproductive growth. So in a sense, a big panicle as well as tissue to store simple sugars in the stem really may be an advantage in the long run. Again, be efficient in carbon metabolism, targeting towards C6 carbons. We have a study going on with the Joint Bioenergy Institute in California, and they do high-throughput saccharification studies. And what we found in the natural variation is a four-fold difference between roughly 1,000 different individuals in the collection. Four-fold in saccharification. So it's quite significant. They're working with transgenics looking for simple increases on the order of 10 to 20%. And when we sent them data for their saccharification, they were pretty shocked. And again, having the techniques to characterize and use the tremendous phenotypic variation. So in summary, all these collections that we work with have diversity that's abundant. And to us, outliers, both allelic variants and genotypes are gold. They're desirable and they help you buck the trends. And one of the things that came out in the previous symposium is, if we're to be most effective in exploiting gene bank diversity, genomics, high-throughput phenotyping, and high-performance computing will be essential for characterizing and deploying these traits. And actually, where there's limitations on some of the genomic tools as highlighted in the previous symposium, contrasting high-throughput phenotyping. The potential is so great to link high-throughput phenotyping with preliminary assessments of genetic diversity and underlying genetic mechanisms. There's great potential there. And again, high-performance computing is essential and relatively accessible just about everywhere through some of the NSF grid programs that are underway in the country. So with that, I'm going to close and highlight a couple of things that are very encouraging. I've been working in sorghum and genetic resources for over 30 years, and the time now is incredibly, incredibly exciting. In sorghum and other crops, maybe in the next 10 years, there are not going to be any orphan crops. There's going to be so much work going on in all crops that there'll be a network of interesting crops, but no orphans that are left out. I also believe that within sorghum itself, whether we started out with NSF bread funding, DOE is investing significant monies, Bill Melinda Gates Foundation, project with the Danforth program just went from was contributing working kind through Illumina. And probably in the next 2 years, everything in the sorghum collection in the United States is going to be GBS and resequenced. We also had a community sequencing project approved to generate 30 to 50 more reference sequences in sorghum. We're not maize, and we're not rice, but we're moving along, taking advantage of opportunities. So with that, I'd like to stop and just say I really think it's a great time to be using these resources that are available. And the future is bright for sorghum, but it's also bright for thoughtful PGR people, PGR plant genetic resources people that are interested in employing genetics and computational sciences to evaluate and move that material into breeding pipelines. So with that, I'll stop. Thank you.
Looks like we got time for maybe one or two questions. Mike?
Steve, thanks for the presentation. Maybe I missed this beginning, but so you know, these germplasm collections, the accessions are typically, each accession is typically very, you know, genetically diverse. So I'm just curious, you know, do you have single seed descent material that you're...
We split things when we see interesting things within an accession. So you'll get gradations within an accession. So some were brought back from Africa where people actually reached their hand into a bag and brought back seed from a market in Africa, somewhere in Nigeria or wherever. So that's obvious. We also have heterogeneity in collections because of maybe non-effective handling or mixes that occurred or something. We've had material that's more uniform that are contributed by breeders. So we have a high-throughput phenotyping project through the DOE, and we're having a really hard time working with our engineers to explain. They want to go down and look at maize in Iowa with a hybrid that covers 200 acres and looks relatively uniform, and we're trying to get them to focus on within accession heterogeneity so that we can better understand that and exploit that. So it's really, really important, and we see it a lot in sorghum. Much like they did, I guess, in the past in the German gene bank, early on before the countries were reunified, I guess, the East German collection, when they would grow materials off, they would split them and increase their collection. They had a lot of labor at the time, and that sort of changed. But I guess if it's important, you need to be cognizant of that. That's a really great question.
I mean,